Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, of the making of books, there is no end. How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, thankfully, with me in the studio today is my producer, Mr. Dan Arnfeld. Good afternoon, Dan.
Hello.
Glad to have you here. I do have a rather long comment today, and I'm going to read parts of it. But this is from Mr. Murray in Australia. And he has sent me some things before. And today, well, earlier in the week, he sent me a picture of one of his relatives with Winston Churchill. And it's really beautiful. I wish we could show it to you, but we can't. But he wrote me, he said, Dear Mr. Leap, he said, thank you for the great thrill it was to hear you read my comments at the beginning of episode 326. So I had obviously read an earlier comment and from him, and he said he was just really excited to hear it. He said, you will be pleased to learn that my son continues to have a fascination with the Churchill documentary we have and replays it regularly. So that's really exciting that that young people are getting interested in Winston Churchill and what we're doing here on the radio. And we really, really appreciate that. And I do want to do more for young readers as we go on. And sometimes there's just been so many other things we feel like we need to cover, but we're not going to let these youngsters out very long. He said, you asked if I was related to the Earl, and at my last visit to the place, he produced a family tree the length of his dining table, and he said he would copy it so I could study it. This was Malcolm Murray, did mention that his father, Kenneth, the 11th Earl of England, or the 11th Earl, and my grandfather, also called Malcolm Murray, had traced a connection, but I supposed all Murrays can trace back to a common ancestry over 700 years ago in Scotland. And so remember now that his relative, the Earl, had received the Victoria Cross. He said the Earl of Dunmore, titled, moved from Scotland to Tasmania following the death of the 9th Earl. Interestingly, the 11th Earl visited Virginia in 1986 to grant a proclamation to revoke and rescind a hue and cry issued by his great-grandfather, the 4th Earl, and governor of Virginia against the revolutionary Patrick Henry in 1775. So you can see that British and American history really is it's still tied together. He said the 11th Earl wished to write the record of old and add a footnote to history by vindicating the memory of Patrick Henry's stand for freedom and liberty. So he goes on to say, it has been an immense honor to be the 12th Earl official bagpiper in Australia. He and his son were guests at my wife and my marriage ceremony, and his son kindly attended wearing the kilt inherited from the Victoria Cross winner. The 8th Earl, amazingly another Victoria Cross winner who was born in Tasmania, became the most awarded soldier in the British Empire. He was also a Murray. Harry Murray fought with the Australian Imperial Force in World War I. So on the subject of relatives, and to return to the topic at hand, Churchill, a lovely color photo of Churchill was displayed at my grandfather's family home in Tasmania. It was taken in London following the news of the surrender of Germany in May 1945. Churchill appears in the photo with members of his military staff seated on the right of the photo, and the reason for that picture displayed at my grandfather's home is his cousin, First Sea Lord Admiral Andrew Cunningham. So Mr. Murray, thank you for sending this. This is history. And it really makes things with Churchill come alive. And the fact that you are an official bagpiper. I wish you could come and play some bagpipes to me. I cry every time I hear a bagpipe. He says, who knows, perhaps one day I could pipe you at a Feast or Tabernacles event or similar in the future. After all, our families share a similar crest in our heraldry, the mermaid. I said, finally, I endorse your idea of ending the broadcast with a cliffhanger. Most compelling indeed. So that's a vote for you, Mr. Dan Arnfeld. So anyway, Mr. Murray, I'm going to show this to Mr. Fleury. And, of course, Mr. Darrell Fleury really loves Churchill as well. All of us should love Churchill. And the thing is, it's so great to have a bagpiper in the family. All right. So for today's program, what I want to do is I want to finish chapter 12 titled The Tira Expedition and then give some, then hit the highlights from chapter 13. And that title is called A Difficulty with Kitchener. Now, we shouldn't just use his last name. It's Sir Herbert Kitchener, but I think probably Winston Churchill, because he had difficulty with him, probably called him Kitchener a lot, you know. So today, begin today. Let's do some review. I want to go back to page 155. And I'm doing this to get us ready for finishing this book. And next time, of course, I'm going to cover some new material next time, but then we're going to end the series with probably the next program, because a lot of the series of what's left in the book is about the Boer War. And the thing is, I wanted to get into a different book, and there's a great author who has done a really good job on it. Her name is Candace Millard. And she wrote a book called Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, and The Making of Winston Churchill. And I think you're going to understand as we go through this program today why I want to do it this way. In other words, you can read about Churchill and the Boer War in many different books. He wrote a separate book just on the Boer War. And the thing is I don't want to give away the whole program today, but if you look at it, when Winston Churchill was in the Boer War, he wasn't there as a soldier. He was there as a writer. He was, you know, writing on the Boer War. And so in some ways it was what happened to him in the Boer War. He did do some very courageous things, but also his development as a writer just was really increased magnificently. And so I think you'll see how this all ties together as we go through today. So I want to start at the bottom of page 155 now, and remember, we've already covered some of this, but I think it's a good review. And remember now, he has written his first book, and it was very very well received. It was on the Malaccan War, what happened in India. And it was so impressive to the Duke of Wales, or the Prince of Wales, I should say, not the Duke, the Prince, that he wrote him. He wrote Winston. He said, My dear Winston, I cannot resist writing a few lines to congratulate you on the success of your book. I have read it with the greatest possible interest, and I think the descriptions and the language generally excellent. Everybody is reading it. I only hear it spoken of with praise. Having now seen active service, you will wish to see more and have as great a chance, I am sure, of winning the Victoria Cross as Fincastle had. And remember now, Fincastle is I think it's the cousin of Mr. Murray, who's written to us several times. He says, I hope you will not follow the example of the latter, who, I regret to say, intends leaving the army in order to go into Parliament. And so here the Prince of Wales, he says to Winston, I don't want you to leave the army. And as we get through the next couple chapters, we're going to see that's exactly what he does. He does leave the army. So that's, we're getting a little bit ahead. I wanted to make that a big secret, but I can't do that and do what I want to do with the program today. The prince then goes on, or the Prince of Wales goes on to say, this is page 156 at the top. He says, you have plenty of time before you and should certainly stick to the army before adding MP to your name, hoping that you are flourishing. He says, I am yours very sincerely, A.E. So we've read that before. But it is interesting that the Prince of Wales was so, you know, excited about what he had written. And it just proves that he was really a, you know, top quality writer as well. All right, let's go to the bottom of page 158 now. And one of the things I just want to tell you is that, and remind you of, is that Winston Churchill was a schemer. You know, he's out of one conflict and he wants to get in the other conflict, and you know, he was doing well with writing, he really gets himself into some trouble. So at the bottom of this page of his early life, he said he's talking about what, you know, he wants to get moved. He's got a scheme going. He wants to get moved, you know, out of Bangalore, and he wants to, you know, become part of the Malaccan force forever, I guess. Remember that we talked about the Punjabis, and he couldn't speak their language and had to like mimic everything. He said, so forthwith, my situation changed in a moment from disfavor and irregularity to commanding advantage. And so he had the trouble, you know, he was trying to get into Sir William Lockhart's camp, and, you know, there's just some people were really against him for doing this. And, but like he said right here, sometimes things change for him in a moment. Now I'll skip down to the bottom. He said, for the first fortnight, this is after, I think I read some of this last time. It's something was put in a newspaper in England, and the commanders in chief were so just irritated that the Gazette was going to publish something about the army and the British army. And there were problems in it, and Winston really began to see that. Anyway, so he gets there, and I think he's with Sir William Lockhart now. And I think this is kind of really insightful. He says, for the first fortnight, I behaved and was treated as befitting my youth and subordinate station. So he gets moved over to Sir William Lockhart's staff. And for the first time in his life, he realized he needs to keep his mouth shut. He says, let me repeat that. He said, the first fortnight, this is after coming with Sir William Lockhart, he finally got moved. He said, for the first fortnight, I behaved and was treated as befitted my youth and subordinate station. I sat silent at meals or only rarely asked a tactful question. But an incident presently occurred which gave me quite a different footing on Sir William Lockhart's staff. Captain Haldane used to take me with him on his daily walk, and we soon became intimate, and that means good friends. He told me a good many things about the general and the staff, about the army and the operation as viewed from the inside, which showed me that much went on of which I and the general public were unconscious. So there were real problems going on inside Sir William Lockhart's staff. He says, one day he mentioned that a newspaper correspondent who had been sent home to England had written an article for the Fortnightly Review criticizing severely, and as he said, unfairly, the whole conduct of the Tira expedition. The general headquarters staff had been deeply wounded by this cruel attack. The chief of the staff, General Nicholson, who afterward rose to the head of the British Army and was already well known as Old Nick, had written a masterly or at least a dusty rejoinder. This had already been dispatched to England by the last mail. Now, that is not something that military people want is someone on the inside giving info about how bad it is on the inside. And then he goes on to say, now, here at any rate, I saw an opportunity of returning the kindness which I had been treated by giving good and prompt advice. So he's a schemer. I mean, he's thinking, now is my opportunity. I can open my mouth now. I don't have to stay quiet. I can ask questions at dinner now. And so he's talking to this, military leader. He said, so I said that it would be considered most undignified and even improper for a high officer on the staff of the army in the field to enter into newspaper controversy about the conduct of operations with a dismissed war correspondent. So this war correspondent obviously was in the military as well. So he didn't get something he wanted. He said that I was sure the government would be surprised and the war office furious that the army staff were expected to leave their defense to their superiors or to the politicians, and that no matter how good the arguments were, the mere fact of advancing them would be everywhere taken as a sign of weakness. Captain Haldane was much disturbed. We turned round and went home at once. All that night there were confabulations between the commander-in-chief and his staff officers. The next day I was asked, how could the article already in the Post be stopped? He goes on to say, ought the War Office to be told to put pressure upon the editor of the Fortnightly Review and forbid him to print it when it was received? Would he be likely to obey such a request? I said he was presumably a gentleman, and then if he received a cable from the author asking him not to print the article, he would instantly comply and bear his disappointment as he might. A cable was accordingly sent and received a reassuring reply. After this, I began to be taken much more into the confidential circles of the staff and was treated as if I were quite a grown-up. Indeed, I think I was now very favorably situated for opening of the spring campaign, and I began to have hopes of getting my teeth into serious affairs. So he was good for a couple of weeks, but the inner Winston came out. And there's an inner Denny, too, by the way. And I'm sure there's an inner Dan. And we all have to face our carnal natures. Anyway, he said, man, I'm going to get into serious affairs now. It says, the commander-in-chief seemed well pleased with me, and I was altogether in the swim. Unhappily for me, at least, my good fortune had come too late. The operations which were expected every day to recommence on an even larger scale gradually languished, then dissolved in prolonged negotiations with the tribesmen, and finally resulted in a lasting peace, the wisdom of which, as a budding politician, I was forced to approve, but which had nothing to do with the business that had brought me to the Peshawar. And it's really, I think, very commendable the way how open he is about it. First, he knew he had to keep his mouth shut. Then he thought, man, I'm really into the big times. And now he's like, now I'm down. I'm down to little guy again. And this is a great paragraph at the end there. He says, thus the beaver builds his dam, and thus when his fishing is about to begin, comes the flood and sweeps his work and luck and fish away together. So he has to begin again. Now he's applying that to himself. He had to begin again. And chapter 13, I think is a really good chapter. And it just shows that Winston Churchill was willing to examine himself and then expose himself to everybody in his books. But the title of this chapter is A Difficulty with Kitchener. And he's actually talking about Sir Herbert Kitchener, who was pretty famous in England. And you'll see as we go through this. But again, I think this is a really good chapter. It has nothing to do with the Boer War, but it has everything to do with another very famous battle that Britain had to fight. He said, again, the title of the chapter 13 is Difficulty with Kitchener. He said, the fighting on the Indian frontier had scarcely closed before the rumors of a new campaign in the Sudan began to ripen into certainty. So this really hit Winston immediately. Wow, there's another campaign. There's going to be more soldiers sent. Wow, I want to be there. And, of course, now he spells this S-O-U-D-A-N, but it's actually S-U-D-A-N for Americans. It's Sudan. It's in Africa. It says, the determination of Lord Salisbury's government to advance to Khartoum, crush the dervish power, and liberate these immense regions from the withering tyranny was openly avowed. Even while the Tira Expeditionary Force was being demobilized, the first phase of a new operation began, and Sir Herbert Kitchener, with a British and Egyptian force of about 20,000 men, had already reached the confluence of the Nile, and at Atbara had in fierce action destroyed the army of Mahmud, the Khalifa's lieutenant, which had been sent to oppose him. So the Sudan, this totally got Winston's attention, and he was now going to scheme his way to get to the Sudan. And it was a little bit more of a struggle for him here. He said, there remained only the final phase of the long drama of the Sudan, the advance 200 miles southward to the Dervish capital, and the decisive battle with the whole strength of the Dervish Empire. I was deeply anxious to share in this. So you almost could say to him, when were you not deeply anxious to get involved in anything? And you want to remind him, now remember now, when you faced the Pathans, you thought this was going to be fun. And then at the end, it wasn't so much fun. And but anyway, he was deeply anxious. He said, but now I began to encounter resistance of a new and formidable character. And so this is a great, great paragraph for all of us who have human nature, because he's coming to grips with himself. He said, but now I began to encounter resistance of a new and formidable character. When I had first gone into the army and wanted to go on active service, nearly everyone had been friendly and encouraging. And then he quotes a little poem. He says, all the world looked kind, as it will look sometimes with the first stare, which youth would not act ill to keep in mind. So this is a little poem. It's a little philosophical. You know, you got to be careful. You know, when you're a youth, you got to watch, you know, watch your P's and Q's, watch how you handle yourself. And he goes down to say, the first stare was certainly over. I now perceived that there were many ill-informed and ill-disposed people who did not take a favorable view of my activities. He said, on the contrary, they began to develop an adverse and even a hostile attitude. They began to say things like this, who the devil is this fellow? How has he managed to get to these different campaigns? Why should he write for the papers and serve as an officer at the same time? Why should a subaltern praise or criticize his senior officers? Why should generals show him favor? How does he get so much leave from his regiment? Look at all the hardworking men who have never stirred an inch from the daily round and common task. We have had quite enough of this, too much indeed. He's very young, and later on he may be all right. But now a long period of discipline and routine is what Second Lieutenant Churchill requires. So that's funny. I think it's funny. But sometimes Second Lieutenant Dennis has had to have his discipline as well. Others proceeded to be actually abusive, and the expressions metal hunter, self-advertiser were used from time to time in some high and some low military circles in a manner which I am sure surprised and the pain the readers of these notes. It is melancholy to be forced to record these less amiable aspects of human nature, which by a most curious and indeed unaccountable coincidence have always seemed to present themselves in the wake of my innocent footsteps and even sometimes across the path on which I wish to proceed. So here he's being really honest. He said, at any rate, quite early in the process of making my arrangements to take part in the Sudan campaign, I became conscious of the unconcealed disapproval and hostility of the Sirdar of the Egyptian army, Sir Herbert Kitchener. And so the point is, Winston wants to go to Sudan. Winston's prestige actually was turned to hostile attitudes. Sir Herbert Kitchener does not like him. He doesn't want him in Sudan. And it is interesting. But essentially, if you go to page 163, he eventually meets up. I'm not going to read all of that. You can read some of that yourself. But Kitchener just said, absolutely not. You're not coming. And so, but then, remember, Winston's family was really connected. And Winston's mom really knew how to get what he wanted because of men. And we don't need to talk about how she got their attention. But here in the middle of the page, 163, he says, but now at this moment, a quite unexpected event occurred. Lord Salisbury, the prime minister whose political relations with my father had not been without their tragic aspect, happened to read The Malakan Field Force. That was his book. He happened to read it. And it was the prime minister that actually got him to the Sudan. All right. Well, that's all for today's program. Now, on our next program, we will finish this book with chapter 16. And I'll probably finish a little bit more on this chapter on Kitchener as well. And then I'm going to announce next time our next book that we're going to read about Winston Churchill's heroic adventures in South Africa. Now, you can buy my early life at Amazon.com. You may be able to find a good used copy at abebooks.com. You may also be able to find a copy in your local bookstore. Now, of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you have to jbl@pcrg.org. You can also follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And don't forget, I also have a Shakespeare podcast that is really exciting. And you should tune in on that one as well. All right. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.